case, Dr. Bluestein versus Central Wisconsin Anesthesiology. Ms. Hines.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Attorney Janet Hines here representing the appellants. I believe the crux of this case revolves around the definition of employee and whether Dr. Linda Bluestein met that definition or could at least set forth a prima facie case and some evidence of pretext to survive summary judgment. That is the threshold question that the district court used to dismiss the case, even though it did go on to briefly address the merits of the other claims. We believe that we have presented sufficient evidence to at least raise a question of fact as to whether Dr. Bluestein qualified as an employee.
You know, you did not, or maybe I missed it, respond to the defendant's argument about Dr. Bluestein's August 24th, 2010 letter to her colleagues saying that she could not meet the physical demands of her job. Why would that letter not be a smoking gun that would end her disability claim? Because if she concedes she can't perform her job, how then is she a qualified individual?
Well, Your Honor, there were a number of communications between Dr. Bluestein and various members of the board and other physicians in the practice, none of which corroborate that statement. We are certainly not denying that she wrote that in the letter. The problem is the context around that, because we have in the record at pages 46 and 48 of the appendix her statements at a shareholder meeting both before and after the date of that letter, in which she explained that she could in fact return to work with restrictions. The one following that was on September 1st of 2010, and when asked if she could return to work 100%, she said no. But that was the issue with the disability claim, because CWA repeatedly insisted that she be able to return to work 100% without restrictions. And under that scenario, she explained that, no, I cannot practice anesthesia 100% healed because I'm not.
Has she ever returned to work as an anesthesiologist?
Yes, Your Honor. And my understanding is that she has had, she has been practicing as a locum tenens, essentially a temp in the doctor world, and that no other subsequent employer has ever had an issue with the relatively minor accommodations that she has requested. She's always received them from the other employers.
What is her best evidence in the record that her impairment had a substantial effect on her major life activities, and where in the record would we find evidence of the degree of impairment?
Mm-hmm. That best evidence is found in the discovery responses that Dr. Bluestein provided to the defense, in which she explained, as noted by the district court, what specific life activities she had difficulty performing because of her disabilities. I believe we fleshed that out at least somewhat in the blue brief. I will see if I can find that briefly.
It's the degree of impairment that I'm talking
about. Right. Well, when she was asked to identify how the disabilities affected her activities of daily life, she did include things like standing and walking and being able to care for herself. She did not have the opportunity to elaborate further, as the defense never took her deposition in this case, and discovery came to an early end in this case, and so there was no further opportunity for her to expound on that.
Did Dr. Bluestein vote at the meeting that decided her termination?
I believe she did. Obviously against. Because
the defendants say that vote against was probably hers.
Right, and there's no way to know from the record, just because of the way the votes were conducted, whether it was hers, but I think it's safe to presume that she was the person voting against her own termination. The defense has also made an issue, while we're discussing the disability claim, of claiming that she did not adequately advise CWA of what her specific physical conditions were that limited her. There's a specific reference in the record, page 45 of the appendix, where CWA admits that she advised them in writing of her specific disabilities. And this has to be taken a little bit in context. I mean, we are talking about an anesthesiologist practice with all physicians who have extensive medical training and would have understood those medical terms that she used much more than your average coworkers in the American workplace. So it was one specialist using specialist language to other specialists to explain what her issue was.
Wasn't there still some, notwithstanding, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but wasn't there still some confusion about what it really was that was the problem?
Well, there were initial diagnoses, and then as the treatment progressed, it was not entirely clear which of the issues was paramount and how best to resolve the underlying hamstring tendon issue, basically. And so rather than undergo surgery, she first tried alternative therapy methods and less invasive techniques to try to resolve the issue. And you'll see from the record as well that she consulted with a number of other physicians about this condition. But again, in the medical world, you're able to do that more on an informal basis without necessarily being formally treated by those physicians. And so there's not the extensive medical record that there would necessarily be if a layperson were involved.
You know, on page 30 of the defendant's brief, they claim that you cite documents that are not part of the record. Are they correct?
Let me look at that reference,
Your
Honor.
Page 30.
I believe it's a little bit confusing how they refer to it, because in our proposed findings of fact on summary judgment, we explained that actions that had been taken by the practice that she had not seen verification of. It was not necessarily a specific reference. We do have our proposed findings of fact in the appendix at page 20.
So is that where we would find these alleged documents?
A reference to them.
Uh-huh.
They're referring to proposed findings of fact 45 through 49, and that begins on page 44 of the appendix.
Thank you.
Sure. In fact, I'm not sure what they're referring to there, Your Honor. But she did provide evidence of all of the required elements of proof under both the disability discrimination claim and the sex discrimination claim. In particular, under the disability discrimination claim, the defense is claiming that some of her testimony was self-serving and doesn't is not supported by other documents in the record. Well, the plaintiff's testimony does also serve as competent evidence and should be considered, not just, you know, dismissed and labeled as self-serving. Also, one very troubling aspect of the defense's brief regarding the disability discrimination claim is that almost every case they cite is pre-ADAAA. The Americans with Disabilities Act was amended at the beginning of 2009 and substantially expanded the range of people who could be considered disabled and severely curtailed the amount of time that a court was supposed to spend examining whether a person qualified as someone with a disability. And so the restrictions they cite in their cases apply to events that occurred prior to January 1, 2009, whereas the events here began in the fall of 2009 and continued through her termination in 2010. So that that is why there is such a disparity in the case law between our citations and theirs, because we believe theirs are largely inapposite because of the massive change that was enacted by Congress to the ADAAA. And there certainly was nothing in the way of any type of interactive dialogue between the parties as to what accommodation might be reasonable for her. And this court in particular has explained that whether a request accommodation is reasonable is really a two-pronged aspect. First, whether it's efficacious, and then whether it's proportional to costs. And there was no discussion of any kind relating to the cost of any of her requested accommodations, let alone their efficaciousness. In particular, the defense does point out that there were brief periods of time when she was allowed to wear a lightweight lead apron while conducting her duties, but that it was only for a very brief time, and then they required her to return to just regular practice without receiving those types of accommodations.
How could she participate in without the apron in her duties? I mean, what?
Well, she certainly could participate if she were wearing a lighter weight lead apron. The crux of the issue was standing, particularly in a heavy lead apron. That was difficult, and they do make much lighter lead aprons that the facility did have available because they did actually provide her one for a week, but they refused to do that on a longer term basis. Whereas now her subsequent employers have actually done that.
I'm not sure I'm following this, but I'm only familiar from the dentist's office about,
right,
about the apron.
Right. Apparently, there are two different weights.
Yeah, and I noticed they always walk out when you were.
Right.
Yeah. They leave. Right.
They leave while you're there. But if there's a lightweight apron, mm-hmm, that satisfies, I'm not sure why do you even have a heavier apron, I guess, if you know.
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, but I suspect it's just a question of the advancement of technology. And
so
perhaps,
they had one on site, and
yes,
and the allegation is she was precluded from using a lighter one, though it was she did for a period of time?
For a week. They allowed her to do it for a week.
Who is they?
The board members, Dr. Mason, Dean Kellner, those individuals. But then they would not allow her to continue using the lightweight apron, which would have solved a whole host of problems and resolved the issue right there, likely.
I guess it goes partly to Judge Flump. If it's an accommodation, it's dangerous because it's lightweight. That's one thing, but
there's no evidence in the record of that. It's just a question. It's not a question of heaviness in terms of protection from the rays. It's just how many pounds the apron wears.
Right, on her weight. But I don't see a difference. Obviously, we're not going to get an answer to that question. But I don't. If a lightweight is as effective as a heavyweight, what's the difference?
Well, that's sort of how we thought about it, Your Honor. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve
all right
that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. Mr. Robinson?
It's
So what is the difference between the lightweight and the heavyweight apron?
I will answer that in just a second. I want to follow the oral argument procedures, which say I'm supposed to introduce myself. So I am Edward Robinson. I'm with the law firm of Cannon and Dunphy in Brookfield, Wisconsin. And I'm lead counsel for the Appalachian Central Wisconsin Anesthesiology SC, which is a service corporation that's in the business of providing professional anesthesia services to patients.
Now you
to answer your question, it's just a matter of one is being heavier than the other. But I want to get back to the judge's question here because this is much to do
well,
about nothing.
Does it answer my question?
Yeah, it's just a lighter weight. I don't think there's any difference between the one or the other. I don't know why they would have a heavy one as opposed to a light one if the light one does the job of the heavy
one.
Then
why did they say you have to wear the heavy one?
They never did. That's my point. The key issue here, timetable, Your Honor, is to focus on August and September of 2010. That's when the adverse employment decision that they're suing about occurred. The record talks about accommodations that were provided up to that point in time. One of the accommodations was she made a request to be allowed to use a lightweight apron, and that was accommodated. Now, she's arguing prior to August, September of 2010 that she made this request on some other occasion. That's disputed. That's not admitted. That's disputed. But that's not material to the dispute because over time, as set forth in the chronology in the brief, over time, we get to the point where by August of 2010, she takes off, Dr. Bluestein, the entire month of August because she wants to recuperate, and she feels she needs the time off. And then when she, in advance of coming back to work, it was expected that she would come back to work on September 1st of 2010. In advance of that is when she issued that letter that's been referenced already, the August 24th, 2010 letter that she wrote. In her own words, there's no dispute. And she says in that letter that she's requesting an open-ended medical leave. And the reason she's requesting an open-ended medical leave is because she says that she, in conjunction with her doctors, have come to the conclusion that she cannot perform she cannot meet the physical demands of practicing anesthesiology.
Then how can you argue both, that she was not a qualified individual and that she was not disabled? You seem to accept her August 2010 letter as conclusive evidence that she could not perform her job, but you are also contending that she's produced no evidence of a substantial impairment.
No, the fact of the matter is, Your Honor, that the partners...
How do you reckon?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's a good question. And I could understand how it might seem to be inconsistent, but here's the explanation. While this was all going on, she had been a partner of the group for 14 years. Or 11 years, sorry. She had been hired there 14 years. She had been a partner and a shareholder and a member of the board of directors for the last 11 years. Her partners accepted her letter at face value at that time. That what she was saying in the letter, they just accepted it at face value without asking for more information. When she says that she, in conjunction with her doctors, have concluded she can't perform the physical demands of practicing anesthesiology, they accepted it. But once she filed the lawsuit in this case, and she decided to file a federal lawsuit, and then we filed a motion for summary judgment. She's required to meet that motion for summary judgment, and she has to prove each of the elements. And so one of the elements she didn't prove is even now, other than saying she has ischiogluteal bursitis and hamstring tendinopathy, those are the two conditions she's highlighted, she still has failed to demonstrate, as the district court correctly found, how either or both of those conditions substantially limited her ability to perform daily activities of living or do her job. So the explanation is she's failed to prove that. She said she had it, but she's failed to prove it. As this court has said time and time again, when a party files a motion for summary judgment, that is the put-up or shut-up moment. And when she was faced with that motion for summary judgment, she failed to prove that part of the claim. But we're here to ask for affirmance of the district court's opinion on all scores. That includes affirming the motion for summary judgment that was granted, the decision and order granting summary judgment, and it also includes the decision and order granting attorney fees to CWA as a prevailing defendant under the fee-shifting statutes under Title VII, as well as the ADA. And as the district court observed here, and this gets back to the timeline, we have to focus on the timeline when the adverse decision was made, which was August and September. At that point in time, the only reasonable accommodation that Dr. Bluestein had made at that point in time was for an open-ended or indefinite leave of absence. That's undisputed in the record. There's not a single document in the record. There's nothing in the record to support that she was requesting any other accommodation short of being allowed to be off of work indefinitely. And this court has said time and time again that the ADA does not guarantee job security because a person may have a disability or illness. They have to be able to perform the essential functions of their job either with or without a reasonable accommodation. And this court has said that it's a matter of common sense that in order for an employee to be able to perform the essential functions of their job, they have to be able to show up at work. And by her own admission, she could not. The other point I need to come back to, there was a statement made about this meeting in September. Your Honor, the record is absolutely clear that she was present at the September 1st board meeting. The records, the minutes of that meeting are part of the record, and it shows that she was there and she voted on this, on whether she should be granted this open-ended leave of absence. And it was voted down, 13-1. The other point that's important is in appellant's proposed findings of fact, they stated, and we did not dispute, that following her termination in September, she applied for and received disability insurance for 6 months. So we now know that she was out disabled on disability insurance from September for the next 6 months, having already been out of work the whole month of August. So we're talking about a seven-month period of time before she was able to return to any gainful employment. And that's not a reasonable burden to impose on an employer to expect that they have to keep a job open for 6 or 7 months hoping that someone might be able to come back and do the job.
How long was Dr. Clancy's leave for medical reasons? Does the record tell us the length of his leave?
I don't believe it does. This was her allegation, Your Honor, that that Dr. Clancy had a medical condition and was out indefinitely and was allowed to come back, but she never developed the facts to support that, as the district court pointed out. What we know, the only thing that is of record is that it's in response to a proposed finding of fact of the appellant at the district court level, I should say, the plaintiff's proposed findings of fact in a response to those. We provided some information about it. So the only information of record is that apparently he had suffered a stroke at some point and had not come back to work. The group put him on deferred compensation, which is only available as a benefit through the partnership or through the group. It's only available if you either retire or you're terminated. So essentially, once he suffered the stroke, they were paying him as if he was terminated or retired. And at some point, he came back to work and was not allowed to come back to work. That's the full extent of what we know about the Dr. Clancy situation from the record. And as the district court correctly pointed out, that she had failed, the appellant failed to demonstrate that Dr. Clancy was similarly situated to her in order to support a Title VII claim. So we get back to why we're here. We're here because the court granted summary judgment based on really two pillars, separate and independent pillars. Number one, based on this court's precedent, the way this group was structured, it's a true partnership. So even though it's a service corporation, every shareholder is a member of the board of directors. Every shareholder gets one vote. The record shows that Dr. Bluestein attended 82 separate board of director meetings over her tenure there. If she wasn't able to appear, the bylaws allowed for any doctor, shareholder, to allow someone to vote by proxy. So even if you can't attend, you can still vote on matters that are brought. This court's precedent, particularly the Schmidt versus Ottawa case, which involves virtually identical facts to this, this court said that when you have a claimant who is a shareholder in a corporation like this and shares in the control of the corporation and also shares in the profits of the corporation, we're going to hold them to be a bona fide employer, not an employee. And the district court said that this case was on all fours with the Schmidt case, and in fact it is. So when this lawsuit was filed and all the time later that it was continued, the bottom line was the precedent of that this court has established presented an insurmountable roadblock that was never going to be able to be overcome, which is she's not an employee. In fact, she supervised the registered nurse anesthetist at the practice. That's what the record established. The other insurmountable hurdle that the district court said she could never overcome was a legion of decisions where this court has said that it's not a reasonable accommodation as a matter of law to ask for an indefinite or an open-ended leave of absence. Those were fatal to her claim then. They're fatal to her claim now. We're also asking for this court to affirm the district court's decision and order granting attorney fees jointly and severally against Dr. Bluestein and her counsel, Janet Hines. And we've also filed a motion, I see my time is up, that we would ask the court to take up.
Time isn't right until the red light comes up.
I never saw any light at all, and now all of a sudden I see the white light.
Well, okay. That doesn't mean it's over. I mean, okay. You're not constitutionally mandated to argue. But
you're close to being over there.
Right.
And as long as we keep talking, you're running out of time.
So we also have a motion pending with the court, and it's a motion under Rule 38 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. It's a motion for sanctions. And we don't bring that motion lightly, nor did we bring the motion lightly in the district court. But this court has indicated that when a party continues to forge ahead with an appeal, especially after the district court has pointed out the fatal problems or flaws with pursuing the case, and they decide to forge ahead anyway, they do so at their own peril. And the court's talked about how when a appellant's brief is basically nothing more than a cut and paste of what was presented at the district court, the court will not look lightly upon that. And that's exactly what we have in this case. And they argue in their brief that this court is required to make a finding of bad faith before sanctions can be awarded under Rule 38, but that's absolutely not the case under this court's precedent. In fact, this court has said that the standard under Rule 38 is an objective standard that looks at the work product, and the court doesn't get engaged in trying to determine the state of mind or animus of the lawyer that's filing the pleadings. So we would request that this court present us with an opportunity. Well, number one, we want the court to determine that just as her district court action was frivolous, her appeal is frivolous as well, and we are asking that the Court of Appeals allow us an opportunity consistent with our motion to file an itemization of the additional attorney fees that unfortunately we've had to incur in order to now prosecute the appeal.
How much were the fees with regard to current counsel as opposed to prior counsel?
With current, are you asking at the district court level, Your Honor? The total amount of attorney fees at the district court level up to that point in time was set in the amount of $72,000, a little more than $72,000.
That was awarded by the district court.
It was awarded by the district court, and that doesn't include any of the time that unfortunately went into the preparation of this appeal. Now I see that I have less than a minute. So the last point I want to make is, even though bad faith isn't required to be shown, we do have the appellant making accusations in their brief accusing the district court of relying on factors that clearly the district court's opinion doesn't show the district court relied upon. And we also have now the appellant arguing on appeal that counsel for CWA has engaged in bad faith conduct. by not bringing a Rule 11 motion, even though the district court pointed out that the basis for our motion for attorney fees was not based on Rule 11. It was based on the separate independent attorney fee shifting statute that exists under Title VII as well as under the ADA. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Honors.
Thank you, Robinson. Ms. Hunt.
Thank you for this brief opportunity in rebuttal. Just as an initial matter, I think this colloquy has sort of highlighted for the court just how many issues of fact there are in this case that are completely in dispute between the parties. As to whether or not Dr. Bluestein was an employee, there's a host of disputed facts regarding the fact that we believe she had little to no control over her fate in the partnership, along the lines of the 32 dismissed partners in the EEOC versus Sidley Austin. And then also...
Well, isn't this actually pretty close to the Schmidt case, Ms. Hines?
On paper, it would be. The problem is that CWA's paperwork bore very little resemblance to the actual practice conducted by the anesthesiology group. An excellent example being the bylaws required elections for president every 2 years. And Dr. Mason got around that by just refusing to hold elections. He was essentially an executive committee of one who ran the ship and did not brook opposition from the other shareholders. He had the unilateral control over the board agenda for the things that even made it on the agenda to be voted on. I mean, it was very much a one-person show. And if I could take one more second and direct the court to the supplemental appendix with the reply brief, especially pages 20 through 26, it highlights a number of the issues that defense counsel has sort of glossed over regarding the requested accommodations, but it certainly was not limited to an open-ended leave.
Thanks, Ms. Hines. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court.